This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor dated Friday, December the 12th, 2025. As always, we'll start in the world section and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, our first headline from today's world section reads, Letter from Paris. France weighs an end to its four-day school week. France is considering adopting a five-day school week. It may seem like the French are late to the party, but it actually highlights how their academic priorities differ from those of the U.S. and how they are shifting now. The date on this particular article is December the 11th, and it is by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. The dateline is Paris. After more than a decade of living in France, I have learned to complain from the best. But when it comes to the structure of the French school day, you'll only hear crickets from me. Forget about the American latchkey kids of my generation. French parents can drop off their children at 8:30 a.m., still make that 9 o'clock meeting, finish their workday, and pick up the kids at 4:30, just in time for a chocolate croissant. However, when I see how difficult it is to find time for piano and gymnastics practice after the long school day and fit in homework, dinner, and a bath before bed, I realize the flaws in the system. While the French school day allows parents to more easily work, it does not give much time for children to play. France's Third Citizens Convention, consisting of 133 randomly chosen participants, has just presented its report on the structure of the French school day after 6 months of debate. The panel consulted more than 80 experts, educational professionals, and youth themselves to figure out how to make the time kids spend in school more conducive to learning, development, and health. The result? 20 proposals, from screen time to parental involvement, that could help schools and children succeed. This is hardly the first time the French have debated the school day. It has been a hot topic for more than 25 years, garnering numerous modifications, reversal of those modifications, and implementations of the same modifications all over again. Most of the debate centers around the number of days and hours that children spend in school. France first experimented with a four-day week in the 1980s after chronobiologists said kids needed a midweek break. In 2013, a school reform added an extra half day to the week, but today, 90% of French towns are back to 4 days. Since 2013, schools have also been required to dedicate a few afternoons each week to extracurricular activities like music, sports, and art. Now, the citizens panel is proposing yet another option, the five-day school week. They're also suggesting that starting classes for junior high and high school students at 9 a.m. in order to respond to the physiological needs of adolescents and finishing the school day earlier for everyone at 3:30 p.m. If this all sounds familiar, you might have been an American high school student in the 1990s like me. Back then, many legislators were in debates over why teenagers were dragging themselves to the bus stop at 6:30 a.m., while elementary-aged kids, who bound out of bed at the crack of dawn, weren't starting school until after 9 o'clock. While it would be easy to brush this off as yet another example of France stereotypically coming to the table decades after the United States, there is actually a method to the madness. The French school day has always been organized with working parents in mind. The country's 7-hour workday allows parents to be there for school pickup, homework, and maybe a hobby after school. But research shows that France's current way of doing things isn't working. Even though French children spend more time in school compared with other member countries than the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, France placed 26th out of 81 countries, behind neighbors Germany, Belgium, and Switzerland, in a 2022 PISA study that evaluated 15-year-olds' understanding of math, reading comprehension, and science. French schools also offer little in the way of structured extracurriculars, like the band, theater, or sports teams that American students enjoy. That means French parents have to pay for private lessons instead, or private classes instead. France numbers among the countries in which the public school system increases social inequalities, not reduces them, according to OECD research. Some observers blame France's academic flop on its generous school vacation schedule, which gives students 2 weeks off every 8 weeks, plus a 2-month summer break. Teachers often complain of having to start all over every time children come back from vacation. Many working parents, including my own circle of friends, loathe school breaks because they require us to find a way to entertain our children for 2 whole weeks, all while somehow keeping our jobs and our sanity. But surprisingly, the Citizens Convention did not suggest changing the amount of school vacations, which alternate by region, all too much. The French tourism industry benefits heavily from them, as do divorced parents who may not live in the same part of France. Instead, the panel proposed dividing vacations into 2 zones, not 3, as is currently the case, and creating a nationwide 1-week break in which everyone can benefit simultaneously. As for the shorter school day, the panel suggested creating a dedicated space for extracurriculars and homework for parents who can't pick up their children at 3:30 p.m. For those who can, that extra hour offers kids a better chance at excelling at their activity of choice. Now that the Citizens Panel has presented its report, President Emmanuel Macron and Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu will weigh in before the report heads to the rest of the government for debate. If it's accepted, French schools could see changes as early as next year. So maybe there is hope of a little more time after school. For all I know, my hubby and I have a virtuoso pianist and a champion athlete in our midst. But I'm not sure what will become of my shortened workday. But if it means my kids have the chance to grow and explore and get better sleep and grades too, wouldn't it be worth it? And again, this particular article is by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. Still in the world section of today's Monitor, our second headline reads, as U.S. seizes oil tanker, Venezuelans focus on daily survival. The United States seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela, upping pressure on Nicolas Maduro's ouster. But Venezuelans are more focused on their day-to-day. The date on this article is December the 11th, and it is by me, Hodris Dahl, who is a contributor at The Monitor. The dateline is Bogota, Colombia. As the United States faces increasing questions about the legality of its military pressure on Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, this week seizing an oil tanker off the Venezuelan coast, Venezuelans inside the South American nation are more focused on personal survival. On a spotty video call from her modest tin-roofed home in Caracas, Venezuela, a grandmother describes how her routines have completely deteriorated in recent years. The cost of food and transportation are increasingly out of reach for this seamstress, who is being identified by her initials, AC, for her security. Her siblings and children pitch in to keep the lights, internet, and gas on. And ever since the introduction of a government telephone application that Mr. Maduro says allows citizens to report 24 hours a day everything they see, everything they hear, AC finds herself worrying about who she can trust on the streets. It's a fear rooted in reality. She says her niece was detained for 4 months after the disputed July 2024 presidential election, which Mr. Maduro claimed he won without evidence. It was part of a government crackdown involving door-to-door raids of the homes of suspected government opponents. The United States has carried out more than 20 military strikes on suspected drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean and Pacific since early September, killing more than 80 people. It is building up its military in the Caribbean with some 15,000 U.S. troops and the world's largest aircraft carrier now stationed there. U.S. President Donald Trump has directly threatened to strike inside Venezuelan territory and announced on December 10th that the United States had seized a sanctioned oil tanker involved in, quote, an illicit oil shipping network supporting foreign terrorist organizations. It is the first known action by the administration against a Venezuela-related tanker since the military buildup. Although direct military action is at odds with international norms of non-intervention established over the past several decades, many in the region, including governments that have taken in the estimated 8 million Venezuelans who have fled growing economic, humanitarian, and political crisis since 2014, many are ready for change. AC says she hopes Mr. Trump's pressure on Mr. Maduro will lead to a democratic transition. For now, she doesn't have the luxury of daydreaming about what that might look like. Her family can afford ingredients for basic meals, including meat twice a week, but there's no money left for anything else, she says. She needs dental attention but can't afford it. It makes me feel ashamed, she said. But AC is better off than many around her. Looking down from her living room window in her hilltop home, she can see children playing outside. After 5 minutes, they sit down because they don't have much energy, she says, of the effects of the lack of sustenance. A 2025 study by Caritas found that nearly 80% of Venezuelan families exhaust their savings in order to eat, and more than half have gone into debt to put food on the table. Some 90% of households lack regular access to drinking water. Once a regional beacon of democracy and prosperity, Venezuela began a steep political and economic decline in the 2010s. For years, late President Hugo Chavez concentrated power and expanded military influence over civilian institutions. A drop in global oil prices exposed years of underinvestment and mismanagement in the state-run oil sector. The crisis deepened under his successor, Mr. Maduro. The economy shrank by roughly three-quarters between 2014 and 2021. As Mr. Maduro's popularity slipped, the government grew more repressive, locking up protesters, activists, journalists, defecting military officers, and members of the political opposition. This week, opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who has been in hiding in Venezuela since January and has been barred by Mr. Maduro from leaving the country since 2014, took the risk of traveling to Oslo for the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Her daughter accepted the award on her behalf as Ms. Machado reached Norway several hours later. Heightened tensions between the United States and Venezuela have put the Venezuelan government on edge, increasing repression inside the country. And it cuts to the U.S. agency and cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development and other sources of funding this year have created major gaps in humanitarian response for Venezuelans in need, says Karen Donnelly, Senior Vice President of International Programs at the International Rescue Committee. Of 38 humanitarian organizations providing services in Cucuta, a Colombian city at the border with Venezuela, 20 are expected to close by year's end when their funding cycle runs out. Public school teacher D.Y., who asked not to be identified by her full name due to fear of government repression, says her local soup kitchen in northern Venezuela shut down last year. Daily struggles often overshadow news about U.S. military threats, D.Y. says, partly because quality information about what is unfolding off the coast of Venezuela is limited. There's a communication blockade. People outside the country know more than those inside, she says. There's no real information here, and a lot gets disguised. AC prays for an end to Mr. Maduro's rule. She's hopeful U.S. military pressure could bring about change for Venezuela. I wish it could be right now that we were done with this government, she says. For DY, the U.S. escalation is one of the only remaining pathways to change. Last year, Venezuelans elected opposition candidate Edmundo González president with 67% of the votes, according to reviews of official voting tallies. But Mr. Maduro didn't recognize the results, claiming he was victorious. If we Venezuelans already did everything we had to do, she says, of voting and taking to the streets in peaceful protest, a military option is the only way out that I see. Years of crisis have made Venezuelans resilient, DY says. She keeps a small stock of food in case of an emergency, something past crises have taught her. Sometimes you have to hit rock bottom to recover and rise again, she says. Even if, for Venezuelans, it's been years of thinking, what more bottom is there for us to hit, adds AC. And a note here, and this particular article is by me, Hojris Dahl, who is a contributor at The Monitor. All right, continuing on from today's world section of The Monitor, the next headline reads, in a region coveted by Putin, how one targeted city carries on. Russia's Vladimir Putin has vowed to take all of the mostly occupied Donetsk region, either through negotiation or militarily. Even as Ukraine resists ceding territory, how is the city of Slovyansk maintaining morale in the face of a forbidding future? The date on this article is December the 10th. It is by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And the dateline is Slovyansk, Ukraine. After a particularly harrowing night of Russian drone and missile strikes this month, Viktoria Horban knew exactly what she would do to lift the spirits of her beleaguered city near the front lines of Russia's war on Ukraine. I thought, today is the right day to put up the Christmas decorations in the shop, says the ebullient store clerk at Ramazan, a women's fashion shop on Slovyansk's main square, where she has helped women feel beautiful for 23 years. I knew the tree and the twinkling lights would cheer people up, she says. With all the sadness and uncertainty we're experiencing, I thought we needed something happy and bright. Despite valiant efforts like Ms. Horban's, these are far from the happiest times in Slovyansk, a city in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region, known for its ceramics industry, and which is less than 20 miles from the front lines. A turbulent decade saw the city briefly seized by Russia-backed separatists in April 2014, then liberated months later at high cost by Ukrainian forces, only to face the accelerating violence of the full-scale invasion, which began in February 2022. Now, a depopulated and largely economically inactive Slovyansk is again under threat. Russia's onslaught of strikes against civilian infrastructure here has recently intensified, while Russian forces on the eastern front line, stalled and perishing at devastating rates over the summer, have again made small, but for Ukrainians, demoralizing territorial advances. But perhaps most harrowing for the people of Slovyansk are Russian President Vladimir Putin's repeated vows to take all of Ukraine's Donetsk region, 70% of which his forces already occupy, either through a diplomatic agreement or militarily. Even as Ukraine and its European allies mount resistance to U.S. pressure for territorial concessions, that menacing vow puts Slovyansk and the neighboring industrial city of Kramatorsk in Mr. Putin's crosshairs, and it leaves Slovyansk residents, now thought to number less than 50,000, down from 111,000 in January 2022, contemplating a forbidding future for themselves and the city they call home. For one thing, they are well aware of the scorched earth tactics Russia has resorted to in the territory it has seized. The nearby city of Pokrovsk, which a fatigue-clad Mr. Putin claimed last week had fallen to his forces, offers the latest testimony. Drone footage accessible online shows a lifeless, bomb-blasted urban expanse of collapsed buildings and charred vehicles. Posts from Russian military media depict soldiers raising the Russian flag over destroyed municipal buildings. On Wednesday, Alexander Sirsky, commander-in-chief of Ukraine's armed forces, said 5 square miles in Pokrovsk's north remained in Ukrainian control. We all know what Putin is saying. Of course, it is very scary, and it makes us think what we might have to do for our family's safety, says Natalia Grigorova, who recently brought husband Andrei and son Mikita on a tour of the Christmas decorations in Slovyansk Mulberry Park, where she is employed. But we don't want to leave. We have made our lives here, she adds as she smiles tenderly at Mikita, who watches ducks floating on a park pond. Slovyansk is our home. The lament and worry that grips people here over the geopolitical vice their region is held in is augmented by knowledge that U.S. President Donald Trump appears to be siding with Mr. Putin on his demand for all of Donetsk. The United States once vowed to support Ukraine against Russia for as long as it takes. White House officials, as well as European officials, briefed on Mr. Trump's latest stab at a Ukraine peace plan, say territorial concessions and specifically the ceding to Russia of all of the larger Donbass region, which includes Donetsk, are indeed a key feature of the proposal. On Sunday, President Trump expressed frustration over Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's resistance to the plan. Then a day later in London, European leaders advised Mr. Zelensky to stand firm on his refusal to cede to Russia any territory under Ukrainian control, including 30% of Donetsk, where an estimated 100,000 Ukrainians live. Mr. Zelensky has said that giving up all of Donetsk, including the cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, would not only gift Mr. Putin territory it might otherwise take him years to conquer, but it would also open the gates to a Russian invasion of regions south and west of Donetsk. Mr. Zelensky said on Wednesday he'd be sending an amended peace plan to the U.S. soon. At the dress shop, Ms. Horban says that though Mr. Putin's pledge directly threatens the people of Slovyansk, it should also be of concern to the wider world. I would ask anyone, how would you feel if someone came to your house and said to you, one way or another, I will take your home, so you might as well just give it to me, she says. But the Russian leader's threat also has implications for international security, she adds. If Putin gets his way, to me, it says we have returned to the days when it's the guy with the biggest stone who wins. At Slovyansk Fire Station 37, senior firefighter and rescue coordinator Dmytro Udalov confirms that Mr. Putin's words are the talk of the town, no doubt part of the Russian president's objective. Everyone is aware of what he says. They know what Russia does in the places it occupies, and it makes them scared, says the Slovyansk native. To explain what Russia does, he turns to fire truck driver Pavlo Cherny, who transferred to Slovyansk from Pokrovsk in January. The fear that what I lived through in Pokrovsk might be repeated here, who wouldn't have that feeling in his stomach, Mr. Cherny says. Mr. Udalov says the last 3 years of firefighting and rescue operations in Slovyansk have demonstrated just how much more dangerous and challenging emergency service work has become. We now have to deal with the glide bombs and the drones, he says, indicating the anti-drone netting that now cloaks the fire trucks like a fishnet. We have to worry about double taps, he says, referring to the Russian practice of hitting a site, waiting for emergency services to arrive, and then striking the same spot to maximize casualties. Just hours after Mr. Udalov spoke, a Russian glide bomb struck a Slovyansk apartment tower, killing one woman and destroying or damaging dozens of apartments. As repair work got underway the next morning, emergency workers in lime green vests tossed chunks of plaster, insulation, and mangled appliances from exposed upper floors. Volunteers with the Angels of Salvation humanitarian organization cut plywood to cover blasted windows against the cold. Outside one building's door, a group of Jehovah's Witnesses waits to help a sister in faith move out belongings while her unit is repaired. These are very stressful times in Sloviansk, so we all... Let me start that one over. These are very special times in very stressful times in Sloviansk. All we can do is help each other and pray to God to support our sister Ludmila, who lost her home, and all of us living here, says Natalia Borzenkova, a nurse who plans to stay in Sloviansk for now because her job is secure. Her fellow church member, Hennadie Kumpan, says he has only swear words he's not supposed to use to describe Mr. Putin, so he vows to keep quiet. But he then offers, how am I supposed to feel when someone comes to my place and says, you can't live here, I'm taking it? For many in Sloviansk, the sign that Mr. Putin's vow has taken a critical step closer to fruition will be the day local administrators declare a mandatory evacuation of children. That, they say, would be a dark day in Sloviansk's fight to remain a place where families can live and flourish in safety. At Fire Station 37, Mr. Udalov says it's always the elderly who must most resist leaving and relocating to safer areas. He understands their sentimental feelings for their homes, but says holding out until the last minute also puts others in danger. And while he has no desire to leave his hometown, Mr. Udalov says... He tells himself his life would not be over just because it was no longer in Sloviansk. I'm not so attached to this place as the elderly are. If I lose my apartment, I can rent one somewhere else. I have even thought, he adds, that if it happened soon, I would be able to see how they celebrate the New Year in another city of Ukraine. And a note here that Oleksandr Nasalenko supported reporting for this story, and the story itself was written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Continuing on from the world section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, Europe wants Germany to arm up. But do Germans want to take up arms? With Europe worried over the threat from Russia, Germany is feeling pressure to lead the way on European defense. Whether Germans themselves are ready to pick up arms is another matter. The date on this article is December the 10th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Berlin. Germany's army is desperately in need of a few thousand good soldiers. Theo Riebel will most certainly not be among them. I don't want to fight for this country, said the student at Berlin's Technical University, sitting on a bench outside the cafeteria. To him, the Russian threat seems remote, and diplomacy is a better solution anyway. Besides, why would he take up arms for a government that he says has only made his life harder with crumbling schools and a rising cost of living? Young people have enough problems already, he adds. Last Friday, the Bundestag, Germany's parliament, passed a bill to increase the army from 183,000 troops to at least 255,000 troops by 2035. It is hoping volunteers will fill that gap. But in January, it is also requiring all 18-year-olds to fill out a form about their willingness to serve, as well as submit to a physical examination if requested. The move is seen as a first step to reinstituting mandatory military service should the push for volunteers fall short. Across Europe, awakened to the Russian threat, other nations are taking similar steps, yet Germany faces perhaps the toughest challenge and the highest stakes. In the words of one expert, Germany's efforts to remake itself as a peaceful nation after World War II have maybe been a bit too successful. Older generations have been shaped by a powerful peace movement that held sway for decades, while younger generations have grown up in a time of unprecedented peace without mandatory military service since 2011. Overall, looms memories of the atrocities of the Nazi army and a fear of the past repeated. A recent poll found that only 18% of Germans were definitely willing to take up arms in a national emergency. The passing of Friday's bill was met by school strikes nationwide. With Europe looking to Germany to lead, the country faces an immense task to build an army capable of defending the nation. Germany will have to overcome the deep aversion to military might that has become a central pillar of its post-war identity. For decades, this anti-war culture played a largely positive role in shaping a new Germany, an open, peaceful, and diverse society, says Dmitry Strachevsky, chairman of the East Europe Center in Berlin, in an email interview. But in today's world, this phenomenon also has another side. This has created a significant mental barrier for millions of Germans. In many ways, this mindset is a testament to how thoroughly Germany has remade itself. A remembrance culture of the country's Nazi past has instilled awareness of patriotism and military power. It also fueled a peace movement that saw 1 million protesters take to the streets in 1983, when NATO sought to put nuclear missiles on West German soil. Most recently, Germany's initial reluctance to send heavy weapons to Ukraine had former Chancellor Olaf Scholz fighting accusations that he and his Social Democratic Party were still bound by their pacifist roots. There are signs this is changing, especially since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There has been an acceptance of real politics, says Janice Grimm, a political scientist at the Free University of Berlin. To defend human rights, peace politics means we need to defend peace. The greater threat to Europe is not a strong Germany, but a weak one, says Patrick Keller, a defense expert at the German Council on Foreign Relations. If Germany doesn't lead, many others in Europe will not move. If we do nothing, others will do nothing as well. A November poll for Bild newspaper found that 58% of Germans say the restoration of national conscription is needed. The question is what Germany's young people think. Britain's Technical University is admittedly not the German army's most promising recruiting ground. Posters promoting the Revolutionary Communist Party are plastered on trash cans and lampposts, alongside others containing anti-fascist messages against the weapons industry. But Linus Wilke brightens when the topic of military service is mentioned. The student sees himself staying at the university, but if I weren't, I would consider it. He has friends in the army, and they have only positive things to say. It is a good plan to grow the military because Russia could become a threat. The concerns voiced by Mr. Riebel, however, echo those of others nationwide. He feels like society is already throwing many of its unresolved problems on his generation's shoulders, with higher rents, increasing stress on social services, and climate change. Now it wants to add another burden to his generation without consulting them. Maybe if everyone was doing okay, it would be different, he says. Lots of people would want to defend their friends, families, and communities. But the country itself, it's not really seen. In Germany and beyond, youth are feeling threatened, says Dr. Grimm, the political scientist. But these insecurities do not lead to wanting to take up arms and defend something. It leads to paralysis. You just don't want to deal with it. Moreover, many German young people see Gaza, not Ukraine, as the urgent crisis. As a result, there are doubts that Germany can hit its targets through volunteers. Only men are required to fill out the new form, and the German Constitution states that no one can be compelled into military service. Community service must be an alternative. It will not be possible to get the numbers without a mandatory component, suggests Dr. Keller of the German Council on Foreign Relations. What we need, he adds, is a conversation as a society. Maybe that is beginning. After the Bundestag passed the military service bill, Defense Minister Boris Pistorius commented on the school strikes. They were fantastic, he said. The prospect of young people wanting to be heard? Be my guest, that's how it should be. And again, this particular article was by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. And here's one final article for today from the World section of The Monitor. The headline reads, Why Netanyahu Has Not Reined in Surging West Bank Settler Violence. In Israeli descriptions of settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, use of the term Jewish terrorism has been rising. A plurality of Israelis say the attackers have been handled too leniently. But the settlers have strong allies in the government. The date on this article is December the 9th. It is by Dina Kraft, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And the dateline is Tel Aviv, Israel. In their videotaped rampages, the violent young Jewish settlers attacking Palestinians in the West Bank are typically seen clad in religious ritual garments worn over their shirts, their faces hidden by balaclavas or scarves. Recently, as they have become more emboldened, they are also seen wearing army fatigues, their faces covered, and armed not only with their usual weaponry of stones and large sticks, but with guns. Violence, in the form of physical beatings, setting fire to homes, mosques, vehicles, and property, and uprooting trees, is a tool they employ in their campaign to terrify and exhaust the Palestinians. Their goal is to force them to abandon their homes, farms, groves, and factories, particularly those in the West Bank's so-called Area C, which contains both Jewish and Palestinian communities. Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, have strongly condemned the settler attacks, and U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned they could potentially impact the delicate ceasefire in Gaza between Israel and Hamas. Despite these warnings and the high stakes involved, the right-wing government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has appeared at least hesitant and possibly politically incapable of reining in the attacks. Settler assaults against Palestinians have been carried out for years, but since the Gaza war broke out with Hamas' brutal October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, and the world focused on Gaza, they have escalated to unprecedented levels. And since the Gaza ceasefire was reached in mid-October, coinciding with the Palestinians' traditional olive harvest period, they have spiked even higher. The term Jewish terrorism has been rising in internal Israeli discourse to describe the wave of settler violence, and condemnation has come from the United Nations, especially of the fall surge. According to the UN, there were more than 260 incidents that caused injury or property damage in October alone, on top of more than 2,600 documented settler attacks previously this year. The World Body's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said the October figures marked the highest number of such violent attacks since they began keeping records in 2006. According to UN data, settler violence has pushed more than 3,200 Palestinians from their homes since the war in Gaza began. Meanwhile, the truce that halted the bulk of fighting in Gaza is increasingly fragile as the sides begin to move toward a second phase, as is the one between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And a majority of Israelis fear another war will erupt in the coming year, according to a survey published on Tuesday by the Israel Democracy Institute in Jerusalem. Of those polled, 59% believe a new Palestinian uprising could erupt in the West Bank in the near future. In the same poll, 45% of Israelis said the settlers are treated too leniently, compared with 22% who said too harshly, and 21% who said they are handled appropriately. Yet despite warnings from some of Israel's security establishment of the potential dangers from this level of lawlessness, bloodshed, and extremism, some of it even directed toward Israel's own soldiers. Analysts say the Netanyahu government is unlikely to rein in the attacks. For one, say the analysts, there's a lack of political will from within the nationalist and religious coalition, for whom a primary goal is Jewish settlement across the West Bank. Making up the ultra-nationalist flank of the government are two key ministers who are themselves settlers. Itamar Ben-Gvir, a longtime provocateur turned Minister of National Security in charge of Israel's police force, and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who is also tasked with overseeing settlements and the West Bank. Most Israelis want to see the attacks end, but the government is not making that happen because they don't want to lose the coalition, fearing that if the extremists within do not get what they want, they will leave the government, says Yohanan Zoref, senior researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. They, the government, think that it's very important to have control of this land, and these young people are doing something which, from their point of view, also serves their interest, and so they are not ready to work against them, he argues. In turn, the extremist settlers feel there's no real power preventing them from doing what they're doing, especially since they are not facing any real punishment, adds Mr. Zoref, former head of the Palestinian Arab Division in the Ministry of Intelligence and Strategy. Israelis are entering an election year, further emboldening the extremists, some analysts say. According to the Israeli rights group Yesh Din, which documents and disseminates data on human rights violations in the West Bank, only 3% of the 1,600 cases of settler violence recorded between 2005 and 2023 resulted in a conviction in court. And citing the low number of cases prosecuted, the group says Israeli law enforcement has been negligent in doing even the most rudimentary part of police work to crack down on ideologically motivated violence. When Mr. Netanyahu did speak out against the settler violence, it was about a week after a photo of a 70-something Jewish Israeli named Oded Yedaya, his face bloodied and fractured by a mass settler, went viral on Israeli social media. Mr. Yedaya, who Mr. Netanyahu knows personally from their days in the military, was in the West Bank village of Beita with other Israeli activists in an effort to deter, or at least document, settler attacks against Palestinians harvesting their olives. As activists like himself and even soldiers trying to break up the violence are increasingly targeted by settlers, he said, the moment may have come when settlers are trying to kill Jews. Mr. Yedaya's daughter Ella wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister asking him to condemn what was going on. You are responsible for those terrorists who almost killed my father yesterday, she wrote in the letter shared on social media. You have been letting this kind of terrorism run rampant for years without intervention. You brought those who support burning villages into the coalition. You have the ability to stop this. Mr. Netanyahu promised that Israel will take very forceful action against the riots against Israel Defense Force soldiers, against Palestinians, because we are a nation of laws, and a nation of laws acts in accordance with the law. He described those carrying out the attacks as a minority that goes into Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and does not represent the large community of law-abiding, loyal settlers. Yet Mehrab Zonzain, a senior analyst on Israel for the International Crisis Group, sees the government's attempt to describe the phenomenon as being carried out by fringe elements within the settlement movement as convenient cover for what she says is its de facto goal of West Bank annexation. If Israel can take down Hezbollah and bomb Tehran, I am sure they can handle a few hundred radicals, she says. I am pretty sure if the rule of law was important to them, they could do something about it. The army understands the instability the violence sows is not good for Israel's own safety, Ms. Zonzain says, But, she adds, there are forces in the government who want the Palestinians out of their homes. Their thinking is, how long can Palestinians deal with no livelihood, no freedom of movement? And again, this particular article is by Dina Kraft, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move right along to the USA section of today's Monitor. And our first headline, which reads, Tracking Pandemic Aid Fraud. 5 years on, the toll continues to grow. A high-profile fraud case in Minnesota has spotlighted the lack of safeguards during the COVID-19 pandemic surrounding funds intended to prop up vulnerable Americans. The looting of taxpayer dollars holds lessons about the social safety net and the federal bureaucracy that oversees it. The date on this story is December the 12th. It is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the U.S. government spent an unprecedented amount of money to prop up the economy and aid Americans whose daily lives had come to a sudden halt. Between 2020 and 2021, President Donald Trump and former President Joe Biden signed a combined 6 laws shelling out over $5 trillion, helping small businesses guarantee paychecks and paying for COVID-19 tests. The money also went toward health care and housing support and to things like emergency food programs for children going without free school lunches. A lot of the money, it turns out, went to fraudsters. 5 years on, the total amount of pandemic relief fraud remains unknown, with estimates ranging from hundreds of billions of dollars to $1 trillion. While federal investigators, private experts, and even citizen sleuths continue to uncover new schemes, they say much of the stolen money may never be identified, much less recovered. The latest high-profile example has come out of Minnesota, where a local nonprofit obtained more than $240 million to feed hungry children, but instead spent the money on luxury cars and real estate. Prosecutors say the sprawling Minnesota case, which continued to expand, a 78th defendant was charged late last month, is linked to a web of other massive fraud schemes, including some involving the state's housing support program, that together could exceed $1 billion. The state's acting U.S. attorney said in announcing charges this fall that the depth of the fraud feels never ending, adding, "It takes my breath away." Many of the Minnesota defendants are of Somali descent, which has added fuel to debates over immigration policies as well as the state's social safety networks, which rank among the most generous in the country. Conservatives have excoriated Democratic Governor Tim Walz and his administration for mismanagement of taxpayer dollars and point to the state as an example of the unintended consequences of big government spending. Governor Walz, who is running for a third term next year, has defended the state's Somali community while signing an executive order to combat fraud within state programs and moving to shut down the housing program altogether. Yet while the Trump administration has made targeting government waste, fraud, and abuse a stated priority of the president's second term, experts say little is being done at the federal level to correct the systematic problems and lack of oversight that allowed so much taxpayer money to be pillaged. Lessons about the pandemic spending and fraud remains relevant today as Washington debates the merits and efficacy of the welfare state and federal bureaucracy that manages it. This month, members of Congress are considering whether to extend tens of billions of dollars in enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies that were enacted as part of one pandemic spending bill. Many congressional Republicans have been citing a recent watchdog report that found a high percentage of fraudulent accounts as a reason to let them expire. There are examples based on hard experience from the pandemic that should be built into any response to a recession going forward, says Matt Weidinger, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute who previously worked on the House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee, which oversees unemployment benefits. One of my roles in life now is to make this argument. Don't do the stuff that was so objectively wrong during the pandemic again. Many experts say they expected some fraud during the pandemic, given the vast sums of money being spent in a hurry. The CARE Act alone, signed by President Trump in late March 2020, sent out more than $2 trillion, making it the largest stimulus package in U.S. history. Just one part of the CARE Act, the $800 billion Paycheck Protection Program, also known as PPP, was equivalent in size to the entire stimulus package that Congress passed in response to the 2008 recession. Haywood Talkove, CEO of LexisNexis Risk Solutions for Government, a company that works with governments to detect fraud, estimates that roughly 8% of government funds are routinely stolen due to fraud. That's in line with an April 2025 report from the Government Accountability Office, GAO, estimating government-wide fraud between 2018 and 2022 to be between 3% and 7%. But Mr. Talkove estimates this percentage went up to 20% for pandemic spending, with $1 trillion of the $5 trillion spent going to fraud. Other estimates put the fraud total in the hundreds of billions, such as a 2023 analysis by the Associated Press that suggested 10% of pandemic relief funding went to fraud, with $280 billion stolen and $123 billion misspent. Government agencies have been slow to update pandemic fraud estimates in recent years, which Mr. Weidinger attributes to embarrassment and desire to move on, given how unlikely it is the government will get much of this money back. Experts agree that three programs in particular accounted for much of the pandemic-era fraud. The Small Business Association's COVID-19 Economic Injury Disaster Loan, EIDL, program, and PPP, as well as the Expanded Unemployment Insurance Program. In many ways, these new or expanded programs were unique to that moment in time. Government officials, both Republicans and Democrats, believed speed was of the essence to prevent economic catastrophe. Some guardrails were removed, either intentionally or as a result of changed circumstances. Most field offices that typically verify identities for benefits were closed. The Small Business Association, SBA, for example, distributed $343 billion in partially or fully forgiven PPP loans to small businesses to cover payrolls and other expenses in just the first 2 weeks. This allowed many businesses to forego immediate layoffs amid stay-at-home orders. But in the name of speed, the government let prospective borrowers self-certify that their information was valid and that their business actually existed. We operated in a trust system, says Mr. Talkove. He and other experts say that speed shouldn't have come at the cost of basic identification requirements. A 2023 report from the SBA found that of the $1.2 trillion in PPP and EIDL spending, $200 billion, or 17%, was distributed to fraudsters. A 2023 GAO report flagged 3.7 million of the 13.4 million PPP and EIDL recipients, or 27%, as potentially fraudulent. Self-certification also contributed to high levels of unemployment insurance fraud. Mr. Weidinger described this as a 1-2 punch. The Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, PUA, program offered benefits to workers previously not covered by unemployment insurance programs, such as independent contractors and the self-employed, who were then allowed to claim retroactive benefits. Essentially, says Blake Hall, co-founder of the ID.me, which partnered with some states during the pandemic to help with identification, the government allowed applicants to pinky promise that they were newly out of work. Mr. Hall cites an example out of Arizona where his company was hired to help with identity verification for PUA claims. Half a year into the pandemic, there were hundreds of thousands of initial claims filed in a single week alone, an improbable number for a state of roughly 7 million, including children, says Mr. Hall. After ID.me services were implemented, such spikes didn't recur. The government also added hundreds of dollars onto typical unemployment checks. As a result, the reward for being a bad guy went up by record amounts, says Mr. Weidinger. Astonishing amounts of money were sent through this system that had very little in the way of identity verification, much less work verification. The bad guys quickly figured this out. The GAO has estimated that $100 billion to $135 billion of unemployment insurance, or between 11 and 15%, went to fraudsters. Mr. Hall puts the estimate closer to $400 billion, a number Mr. Weidinger agrees is likely closer to the actual number than the government's calculation. Mr. Talco thinks the amount is somewhere in the middle, around $250 billion. The first step in fixing a problem is acknowledging it exists, says Mr. Hall. But fraud on this scale can be a hard thing for governments to admit. No government wants to be known as the administration that lost all this money to fraud. Some of the stolen money actually has been clawed back, but not much. As of April 2024, the Department of Justice had criminally charged more than 3,500 defendants and recovered more than $1.4 billion in seized or forfeited CARES Act funds. That's less than 1% of what was stolen from just the two SBA programs alone. A congressional report from earlier this year says the Department of Labor had recovered $5 billion in stolen unemployment insurance funds, roughly 4% of what was lost, according to the government's estimate. Since April 1, 2020, the Department of Labor's Office of the Inspector General has opened more than 200,000 investigations into the unemployment insurance program, a 1,000-fold increase compared with before the pandemic, when unemployment insurance made up 11% of case inventory. As of 2025, it is 96%. With fewer than 130 criminal investigators, the Department of Labor and the Office of the Inspector General has focused on large-scale theft schemes that pose the greatest risk to the unemployment insurance program. And there is a larger question of whether more can now legally be recovered. The Senate failed to vote on the Pandemic Unemployment Fraud Enforcement Act, which passed the House earlier this year, and which would have extended the statute of limitations on pandemic unemployment insurance fraud from 5 to 10 years. President Biden did sign laws in 2022 that extended the statute of limitations for tracking down fraud within the SBA's pandemic programs. A 2023 update said that almost $30 billion in EIDL and PPP funds were seized or returned, or about 15% of what was stolen. But as prosecutors continue to hunt down stolen PPP funds, experts say Washington needs to be looking forward. Even if another pandemic is unlikely, a recession may well come at some point, and many of the enhanced benefit structures that the federal government uses to prop up the economy in those circumstances are similar. Rather than the federal government just throwing additional dollars at states to distribute through their unemployment insurance programs, there should be a shared partnership, says Mr. Weidinger, with clearer lines of responsibility. Getting money to people quickly doesn't need to come at the expense of basic verification, such as running applicants' names through Treasury Department's Do Not Pay database or confirming that the same individuals are not receiving unemployment benefits from multiple states. As former SBA Inspector General Hannibal Ware told the Associated Press, an extra few days of checking applications during the pandemic would not have upended the program or forced businesses to shutter. You have to have some oversight, says Mr. Talkov, and it doesn't mean that you're trying to deny a benefit. And again, this particular article was by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you spending some time with me, listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor for you next week. Thank you for listening.